Equity Leadership Now hosts conversations with equity-conscious leaders from pre-K through university settings who transform structures and strategies for educating, particularly for those who are marginalized. We complement the mission and goals of the 21st Century California School Leadership Academy, 21 CSLA. Housed in the leadership programs of Berkeley School of Education, we acknowledge our presence on unceded Ohlone land. We explore innovative ideas and compelling work of educational leaders at the intersection of research, policy, and practice to realize individual, social, and environmental justice because our democracy depends on it. In episode 4, we delve into a conversation led by the 21 CSLA chair and faculty director of the Berkeley School of Education Leadership Programs, Jabari Mahiri. We'll be discussing the text, Racial Microaggressions, Using Critical Race Theory to Respond to Everyday Racism, from the 21 CSLA 2023 Spring Collective Retreat, with professors Danny G. Solorzano and Lindsay Perez Huber.
Daniel Solorzano is a professor of social science and comparative education and Chicanx and Central American Studies in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Solorzano's teaching, research, and publishing interests include critical race theory in education, racial microaggressions, critical race pedagogy, and critical race spatial analysis. Lindsay Perez Huber is a professor in the Equity Education and Social Justice Master's Program in the College of Education at California State University, Long Beach. Her research specializes in race, immigration, and higher education, racial microaggressions, and critical race-gendered methodologies and epistemologies. We're going to begin by having a question that I thought was interesting to pose because they begin the book with their own origin stories. And if you're a person of color, you can really identify with those origin stories because you have your own. This book appears in James Banks's Multicultural Education series, which is really a provocative series, maybe 40 different publications over time, and you can literally become an expert in multicultural education if you were to just delve deeply into those texts. And James Banks offers his own origin story at the beginning in his preface to the book, and he talks about being an African-American man in the South in the 50s. We won't go any further, but for you all, how did you come to study microaggressions in the first place?
Thank you, Jory. Really appreciate you all inviting us here to share this work with you all. There's a short origin story, and then there's a much longer origin story, and I'll do the short one. And I'll focus mostly on microaggressions because of the focus of the talk and the book. I was working in critical race theory in about 1993. I just heard about it serendipitously, actually. And as I was delving into that literature, which was mostly in the law, I was trying to make the connection to the field that we're in, education, and social sciences and ethnic studies, fields that we're also in. And as I was looking at that literature, I came across a law review article by Peggy Davis in the Yale Law Journal, 1989 article, where the title of the article is Law is Microaggression. So when I seen that article, I'd never seen the word, never heard of the word microaggression. So as I was reading that article, I came to a footnote number 5, and the footnote was a person named C. Pierce. It's Chester Pierce. Mm-hmm. And it was Chester Pierce's articles that there were 10 of them cited in that piece by Peggy Davis that I went in, I read, immersed myself in. We've read just about everything Chester Pierce has written. And I just found out later that his co-author, Wesley Prophet, who's in that first citation number 5, Wesley Prophet, was his doctoral student at Harvard in the School of Public Health. And so I just found that out about a couple of weeks ago, right? And I got his dissertation. Now we're looking at his dissertation, trying to figure out the role that Wesley Prophet plays in the development of this thing called racial microaggressions. So that's where it started. It started with just serendipitously finding this article by Peggy Davis, finding that footnote by Chester Pierce, and then having Chet school us. And he continues to school us in doing this work.
So you go way back in 1992. That's when I first came to Berkeley. So we're talking about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But Lindsay, you were a lot younger in 1992. Give us a couple, you know, sentences about how you came to this work also.
Thank you, Jabari. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I really appreciate the sharing the space with everyone and engaging and hearing your ideas about how you see this work play a role in the work that you're doing as leaders and educators. Yes, so I was quite young in the early 90s. My story kind of starts in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was an undergraduate student trying to make sense of my own really difficult transition into higher education, as I think in terms of origin stories, many of us in this room probably experienced in higher ed, getting really disengaged from many of my classes, not seeing myself in, you know, my undergraduate kind of education, and then finding ethnic studies. And I think ethnic studies in many ways kind of changed my life in terms of changed my perspective, got me re-engaged in higher education, and really kind of propelled me forward to wanting to continue in a PhD program looking at the intersections of race, racism, and education. And at the time, in the early 2000s, there weren't many education programs and PhD programs that were doing this work. And so the first one that I found, actually I found Danny's picture first, right, after doing like a Yahoo search. I don't think Google was even a thing then. But after my Yahoo engine search, I found Danny doing this really amazing study, which I didn't know at the time, but was the first empirical study on racial microaggressions, using critical race theory to examine the everyday racism that Chicana Chicano scholars were experiencing as part of the Ford Foundation Fellows. And so when I came to UCLA, Dr. Walter Allen, also in the graduate school, then the Graduate School of Education, and Danny were working on an amicus brief for the Bollinger case, the Michigan case, affirmative action case. And it was actually in Walter's class where it was kind of my first engagement with racial microaggressions, and then of course working with Danny as a graduate student and being mentored by Danny, where I was really got this experience that I think was unique to learn those tools very deeply.
Well, you lead us directly into the next question, because we know critical race theory is really under attack for all kinds of problematic reasons. But talk a little bit about how you all see critical race theory illuminating the study of racial microaggressions.
It's the work of scholars and practitioners like ourselves who are developing an analytical framework that unapologetically centers or accounts for race and racism in education. That's the first part of the definition. And so that came as a result of immersing myself in that legal literature, these areas that I thought were really important, that I was learning from the law, learning from the law review articles and the field as it was developing there, and then developed these five tenets. The first one is that it centers race and racism. Right? That's the first tenet. That's the work that we do. But it looks at that intersection that I said earlier with gender, with class, with immigration status, et cetera. The second one is that it challenges dominant frameworks. And so in a space like this, we often talk about one of the dominant frameworks that we have to deal with on a daily basis in the space that we find ourselves in is deficit framing, right? Cultural deficit framing. So CRT, in the second tenet, challenges those frameworks. It centers experiential knowledge, and it honors experiential knowledge that people of color bring to spaces like this, bring to schools, bring to our communities and other communities. The fourth is that it has a commitment to racial justice, that we're always looking for ways in which we're going to challenge the status quo, and we're going to bring about social change as we move forward. And then finally, it challenges ahistoricism. And what we often do is that we often say that when we look at a particular issue, it has historical antecedents. And we have to look for those historical antecedents.
Okay, so let's move forward then and recognizing the significance of counter storytelling and centering, you know, this work on the lived experiences. Let's accept that, and then move to this other interesting area of the book where you raise a consideration not only of microaggressions, but also macroaggressions. We're leaders in this room, and so help us to understand how macro and microaggressions connect to institutional racism, and what are key characteristics of how this interplays in the field of education specifically.
One of the examples that we presented in the book, and you can find this, it's actually on page 57, was this photograph. As we were looking for different photographs that we knew we wanted to feature in the book that would really allow folks a powerful visual that would take you through the distinction and overlapping conceptual links between the macro and the microaggression, we found this photo. This was at the it was cataloged in the Library of Congress. It's called A Drinking Fountain on the County Courthouse Lawn. It was taken in 1938 in Halifax County, North Carolina. This is actually the front lawn outside of a North Carolina courthouse, county courthouse. And you see a young African-American boy standing next to this water fountain with the sign colored on the tree next to him. So we use this photo to talk through to our readers in this chapter that the everyday racism, the microaggression that is illustrated in this photo is this young boy next to this colored water fountain, right? That water fountain signifies the everyday ways that this young man had to be reminded that he was less than, had to be reminded that he was not as good as white people who would drink from a separate water fountain. Right? And it was the sign, the colored sign, that represented the Jim Crow law of the time, that was the institutionalized form of racism through, of course, Jim Crow law that segregated public spaces between white folks and African Americans during that time and other people of color. And the macroaggression, we argue, are the ideologies that justify institutionalized racism like Jim Crow law and reinforce and reproduce the everyday racism or the racial microaggressions.
We'll be right back with more of our discussion with Professor Solorzano and Professor Perez Huber at the 21 CSLA Collective Retreat after the break.
Flew through the open window, sounding like heaven to me. Hoist up the banner, humanity. Hoist up the banner of love. Sounding like heaven to me.
I really appreciate how you all have given us these visual representations to help get into the depth of understanding of how complex and subtle sometimes these issues are. You might see a sign on a tree and it just says colored and you walk past it and I realize that that's indexing a whole series of Jim Crow laws, et cetera. So this is very, very powerful. One of the most problematic aspects of the way racism operates in our country has to do with the fact that people who are victims of it also internalize it. And so I'd like to have you guys talk a little bit about and help us understand more about internalized racism with regard to the racial hierarchies within and between communities of color.
We start with an excerpt from the work of Gloria Anzaldúa. For those of you that, many of you in this room, I'm sure, are familiar with Anzaldúa, she's a Chicana feminist theorist and scholar. And this excerpt is from an essay that she wrote called La Prieta. She says, "Too bad mi hijita was morena, muy prieta, so dark and different from her own fair-skinned children. But she loved mi hijita anyway. What I lacked in whiteness, I had in smartness. But it was too bad I was dark like an Indian. Don't go in the sun, my mother would tell me when I wanted to play outside. If you get any darker, they'll mistake you for an Indian. And don't get dirt on your clothes. You don't want people to say that you're a dirty Mexican." And so here we see Anzaldúa talking to us about the painful memory and perception of being less than because of colorism, right, within our communities. So in this context, Anzaldúa is talking about the perceptions of her dark skin compared to her lighter skin siblings from both her mother and her grandmother, who were very important people in her life. And if you read more of this essay and you read more of her work, especially Borderlands, you'll see her talk about the pain that's caused by internalized racism and by colorism when ideologies of white supremacy are internalized within and among communities of color.
We define it in the book as internalized racism is the conscious and or unconscious acceptance of a racial hierarchy and its related ideologies and structures that positions and privileges whites above people of color. That's how we start the definition. We continue by saying that internalized racism goes beyond the internalization of stereotypes imposed by the white majority about people of color. It is the internalization of the beliefs, the values, the worldviews inherent in white supremacy, i.e. the cultural deficiency theory that I mentioned earlier, that can result in negative self and or racial group perceptions. One example, another visual that we use, and this is one of the photos we really wanted to use, the Kenneth and Mamie Clark's doll study as an example. And some of you probably know that this work really originated with Mamie Clark's master's thesis and eventually her dissertation. But it really, what we were looking at is how this young 3-4-year-old was able to internalize the racism of the time. He was able to internalize the colorism of the time. And I think we have some, Mamie would ask the young boy, show me the good doll. And he would inevitably always pick the white doll. She would ask him, show me the nice doll. And he would pick the white doll. So when we talk about, we shouldn't be talking about race to young people, they're already experiencing it.
Do you mind if I throw a fastball?
Oh, sure.
Because what you just said reminds me, and you all began with a discussion of Freire also as one of the key theorists to think about some of these issues of oppression and victimization. And one of his key points is the notion of sub-oppression, that people not only internalize the hierarchies of oppression, but in some cases, when they gain power, they actually replicate those. So you have people of color in positions of power oppressing other people of color. So I just want to throw that little fastball out there to see how your work on microaggressions and internalized racism will help us think about that particular aspect of the problem.
Freire is definitely, certainly influential in our theorizing about racism and systems of oppression. Someone else that was really important, particularly in the theorizing around racist nativism, was Albert Memmi, who talks about, he calls it the pyramid of petty tyrants. Yeah. When people of color begin to internalize, whiteness and white supremacy and begin to do harm to each other. Mm. One of the things that I was really struck by that Rebecca mentioned earlier was that this group of leaders of color is really being intentional about the work to reflect on your own healing, right, in order to do this work. And that's so important because of the harm of everyday racism that has been experienced within the broader society, right, among white folks, but also the harm that's caused within communities.
Yeah, I think it's so important that your book doesn't back away from dealing with this internalized racism. And it's also important that you don't leave us hanging. You don't leave us in the abyss of all of the problems that microaggressions and internalized racism and racism and systems of white supremacy can cause. And you offer us some hope in the way of racial microaffirmations. So what are racial microaffirmations and what are their roles in responding to, disrupting, or ameliorating racial microaggressions?
It began, again, it has an origin story, Jory. And for me, it was this letter. If you've read Henry Louis Gates's his memoir called Colored People in 1994, which I used in my seminar. I was just amazed by his story. But he starts the book by writing a letter to his two daughters, Maggie and Liza. And it's this section, it's a 6-page letter, but I pulled out the sections that I remembered a decade and a half later when Lindsay and I and others were trying to figure out, what does this thing called microaffirmations look like? Who's talked about it? And so I'll read the letter to you, or a portion of the letter. He said, "Dear Maggie and Liza, I have written this book for another reason as well. I remember that once we were walking in Washington, D.C., heading for the National Zoo, and you asked me if I had known the man to whom I had just spoken. I said no. And Liza, you volunteered that you found it embarrassing that I would speak to a complete stranger on the street." He continues on. "Last summer, I sat at a sidewalk cafe in Milan, in Italy. And three or four black Italianos, black Italians, walked casually by. Each spoke to me. Rather, each nodded his head slightly or acknowledged me with a glance ever so subtly. When growing up, we always did this with each other, passing boats in a sea of white folk, which is why I still nod or speak to black people on the street, and why it felt so good to be acknowledged by the Afro-Italians who passed my table at that cafe in Milan. Above all, I enjoy the unselfconscious moments of a shared cultural intimacy, whatever form they take, when no one else is watching, when no white people are around. And I hope you'll understand why I continue to speak to colored people I pass on the streets. Love, Daddy. So it was that letter, mm-hmm. when we were starting to think about this thing called microaffirmation, racial microaffirmations. I went back to this letter. When you read something and it's in the back of your brain somewhere, it's wherever it's at, but it suddenly surfaces. But this is one of the definitions. We say that racial microaffirmations are verbal and nonverbal strategies, or what Gates calls moments of a shared cultural intimacy that people of color use to acknowledge and affirm each other's dignity, their integrity, and shared humanity, and that makes people feel seen and valued. And then the second part is, this is their verbal and nonverbal responses to racial microaggressions. But it also, for me, and I think for Lindsay as well, and for many of you in this room, that affirmation often begins in our homes, in our families. It for me, it also begins in when I first read Malcolm X in 1968 in a World Civilizations class, and how that was the first time I read a book where a person of color was talking to me.
As Danny mentioned, that this is a definition that has taken an evolutionary trajectory over almost a decade now. We actually first started talking about microaffirmations in an article that was about my daughter here up in the front, Layla, when she's a first-year college student now, but when she was around 8 years old, and talking about, she called it the opposite of a microaggression, right? How can we be more hopeful in these conversations, just like you said, Jabari, is that it's important to hold on to that hope, and particularly when we are engaging in these discussions with youth, that as educators, we have a responsibility, I think, to acknowledge that hopefulness, right, for our students and for our youth because of how difficult the conversations around everyday racism can be. And so our most recent study that we've done has been with graduate students of color talking with them about examples of microaffirmations that they've experienced throughout their trajectories from K-12 to undergrad to their graduate school experiences. And what we found using some CRT, of course, but also Chicana feminist tools, is that microaffirmations are felt in the body, right? Our bodies are sites of knowledge production. And so microaffirmations can be seen and heard and smelled and felt. And so part of the definition that we're thinking about now is when we talk about protection, many of our participants in this study talked about microaffirmations as healing and as restorative. And it particularly, when those microaffirmations are these moments of shared cultural intimacy, it's that shared cultural intimacy that allows for that healing.
You've really given a good definition of racial microaffirmations, and you know that I threw a question out to you that you said you had to think a little bit more about. So I'd like to go there as we bring things to a close. Is there a concept of racial macro affirmations? And if so, what would that look like? And if not, why doesn't it exist?
I remember telling Danny, like, I really want to think about this when I'm not so tired, because it's such a great question about the macro affirmation. When we think about how micro affirmations can have an ideology, right? So we're thinking about what are those ideologies? They're, of course, asset-based and asset-informed versus deficit. They are grounded in ideologies of humanity, of value, of integrity, dignity, all those, all of those components of our definition. And then thinking about how they're or can be institutionalized. So how can we think about providing spaces of macro affirmations as schooling structures?
As we draw to a close,
We'd like to thank Professor Danny Serrozano and Professor Lindsay Perez-Huber for sharing their insights and expertise with us today and equipping our leaders with the necessary tools to confront and dismantle systemic injustice in education.
Our podcast team includes Jennifer Elliman, Robin Ilton G, Bree Luna, Bari Mahiri, Audra Pusholsky, Mayra Reyes, Dara Tom, and Ryan Whittle.